Succession number 28353, reel number one.
Very much indeed for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Can I start, as I always do, by asking you for your full name, date of birth, and where you were born, please?
Yes, Peter Ted Squire, born on the 7th of October 1945 at Felixstowe in Suffolk.
And can you tell me something about your family, your parents and brothers and sisters, if any?
Yes, my parents were married in 1942. My father was a farmer's son, one of seven children, Devonians, and he was probably, well, was the only one really to break away from farming when his parents died early in his life. He went off and was looked after by an elder sister in Warwickshire, went to school until 16 at Birmingham, and was then apprentice, an aircraft apprentice, at Holton in Buckinghamshire. He then, on graduation from there, did extremely well, actually, and was very unlucky not to get a place at Cranwell from Holton. And quite why he didn't, when his academic results at Holton certainly would have suggested that he was a candidate for a place. He therefore went on and saw airman service, first of all as an aircraft mechanic, then as an air gunner, before getting a pilot's course in about 1934-35 time, and then served as an NCO pilot, mainly in flying boats until the outbreak of World War II, continued as a flying boat specialist, did the second Empire Test Pilot's course at Boscombe Down in 1943 or 44, by which time he'd got a commission, and then went on for a service career through until his retirement in 1958 with the rank of Wing Commander. As a pilot during World War II, he was distinguished with the award of a DSO and a DFC for operations in the maritime role, and indeed his logbooks bear witness to the fact that he was an exceptional pilot. My mother came also from a Devonian family in Barnstable, perhaps a slightly better off family than my father's was. An only daughter went away to a private school in Ilfracombe, grew up, and at the beginning of the war joined the ATS, and met my father through mutual friends, and they married in 1942. My sister, I have just the one sister, was born in 1943, and I in 1945, when my father was at that stage based at the Maritime Aircraft Experimental Establishment at Felixstowe in Suffolk, which he served on as a staff pilot and then went back to command in about 1948. So I came therefore from a service background, grew up in that sort of environment, although by the time I was really conscious of it, my father's flying days were largely over, and although he continued to fly from time to time in staff appointments, we never served, other than at Felixstowe when I was very small, on an active flying station. On other occasions we were either living in the outskirts of London because he was based in the Air Ministry, or because he was on a flying course at Manby and we were living well away, and then we went to New Zealand as a family between 54 and 56, where again he was working on secondment to the New Zealand Department of Defence. So at no stage was the family, if you like, on an active Air Force station, which certainly I think would have been a catalyst to my joining. But nevertheless, from a very early age, I decided that the Air Force was what I wanted to do and that I wanted to fly. And really, it was a single-minded determination that that was what I was going to do. Had it not worked out, had for some reason I'd been found incapable of passing the various tests and things of that nature, either intelligence, leadership or physical, to join the Air Force, I really don't know quite what I would have done. At no time did my parents lean on me in any way to join the service. I think my father was very questioning of me. You know, did I really want to do it? Was it for the right reasons? Was it just because he had been in it and things of that nature? So there was never any pressure from them, although I have no doubt that they derived considerable satisfaction from the fact that I did choose to follow in his footsteps. They went to great efforts to ensure that I got the best education, which was something that my father had struggled with because of his circumstances. Although he had an extremely good brain, the fact that he left school at 16 and things of that nature was always a disadvantage to him, and meant almost certainly that because he therefore spent a fair length of time as a non-commissioned pilot, his ceiling in the service was already capped because of age and rank relationship. And when, of course, Duncan Sands's white paper came out in 56, then he was a clear candidate at that stage for redundancy. But my parents were very keen that I got a good education, so although finances were never not tight, they made provision for me to go to a prep school in Torquay from the age of 11. I would have gone at 8, but my parents, as I said, were posted to New Zealand, and my mother and father decided that rather than going away to school and staying in this country on my own, they would take me to New Zealand for those 2 years, and I would therefore, my going to prep school would be delayed until I came back. So I went to a prep school in Torquay, which was okay. I can't say that it was the best prep school in the world by any manner of means, but it served its purpose. And from there I managed to get a bursary to a school called King's Bruton in Somerset, which wasn't, fun enough, on our agenda of schools. My parents had thought that I might go to Kelly College in Tavistock, but because the opportunity to sit the scholarship exam came and I managed to achieve something by way of financial support, that was sufficiently attractive to my parents at the time, although I think it was only about £50 a term or something of that nature, for me to go to Bruton. And Bruton was a good school, I felt. It certainly allowed me to do all that I wanted to do in terms of academics, in terms of sport. I was a keen sportsman by that stage, in terms of amateur dramatics, which I enjoyed, in terms of sort of leadership through being prefect and things of that nature. It allowed me to develop in those various ways, which probably gave me the attributes, the sort of attributes that the service were looking for when I went forward for selection in the summer of 1961, just after I had finished O-levels, which had gone well. I'd got sort of good passes in all the 9 or 10 subjects that I had taken O-levels in, and so I was invited, first of all, to turn up at Hornchurch and do something like 3 days of intelligence, aptitude, medical tests at Hornchurch, before the group of us, and I suppose it would have been a group of probably 40 to 50 youngsters, all boys, of course, at that stage, before some were sent home, sadly, either with the answer, no, you're not for us, or come back in a year's time, or something of that nature, whilst the other half went on to Cranmore for another 3 or 4 days of selection tests. It was a fairly nerve-wracking experience, the selection into the two halves, because I know we were all assembled in one room at the end of the third day, and a flight sergeant or senior NCO came in and called out a whole heap of names and took them off with him. And my immediate reaction was, well, that's the half that are going on to Cranmore. We're going to be sort of told to pack our bags and go. And we sat around, and it must have been another 20 or so minutes. And the flight sergeant then came back and said, right, you lot are going off to Cranmore. So the change of the atmosphere, it was the others that had been taken off and given a railway warrant and sent home. One of the sort of apprehensions that I had always had about joining the service was whether my eyes would have been up to it. As a young boy, from the age of probably 3 or 4 until 7, I wore spectacles to correct a squint that I had, a lazy eye, as they used to call it. And although I had successfully ditched the glasses by the time I was 7 or 8, it always occurred to me that my eyes would be, or could be, a problem in selection. In the event, when I went to Hornchurch, they were fine. Nobody commented on them at all, although I will come back to that at a later stage. And so we all were sent on to Cranwell. And I have to say that at the age of sort of 15, as I was, those next 3 days spent at Cranwell in Dedalus House were some of the most fun days I'd had for a very long time. Most of it was orientated around leadership exercises. You get your team from here to there, over the hurdles, with an atomic bomb under your arm, and don't fall in the ditch, and things of that nature, and you've got 15 minutes and 2 short planks and a piece of rope to do it with. And I found those immensely, you know, good fun and interesting and so forth. And again, perhaps because I enjoyed it and therefore entered into it with enthusiasm, was one of the reasons, again, that I was selected at that stage. But one of the hardest things that they got us to do, and I've always thought that this was a pretty tough assignment, is they sat us down on the first morning that we got to Cranwell and got us to write 2 essays. One on how we saw ourselves, and the other on how we thought a friend would see us. And I think for a youngster trying to know the difference in the first place and to express it on paper was quite a tough thing to ask people to do. And I wish I'd kept a copy of those 2 particular essays, but I've always thought back, and because I did identify differences in how I saw myself and how I thought a friend would see me, but it was quite an interesting question to have to answer at that stage of one's life.
Can you recall them? Can you recall the outlines of what you said, or was it too far away now?
Well, I think it is a bit far away now.
Because I don't want to embarrass you with something you wrote at 16 and a half.
Yes, I think I probably would be hard-pressed to say all that I put in it, but I think I was able to identify that some would see me as being someone who was extremely keen to do well, but hopefully not overtly ambitious. If there is a difference, then I would have said about myself that it was a very quiet determination always to do as well as I possibly could. But precisely how I phrased it, I can't recall now, because it is obviously a few years ago. But anyway, the upshot was that at the end of the week, and sometime later, I was notified, or my parents were notified, that I had won an RAF scholarship to Cranwell, which therefore again meant that the Air Force picked up the academic costs or the educational costs of staying on at school for the next 2 years, which again was good news to my parents. The school then did something slightly unusual. It decided that about 8 of us should take our A-levels, or take some A-levels, in the lower 6th year. And so I was a scientist doing maths, physics and chemistry, and so they decided that we should take physics and chemistry at the end of the lower 6th, which we did, and I think all or most of those 6 or 8 youngsters got grades, passing grades at physics and chemistry, therefore after 1 year, which in theory meant that we were able to really focus our attention in the second year on retaking those, but hopefully getting even better results, certainly taking S-level papers and then going into maths and doing both pure and applied maths. I'm not sure what went through my mind, but I think I decided that I had got all that I needed to get to Cranwell, which was just 2 A-levels. It's a bit like the TUI entry to Oxford, as it used to be. And that, therefore, I could perhaps sort of focus my life on other things in the school, being a prefect, playing lots of sport, doing some amateur dramatics, but still trying to work reasonably hard. The net result was that I didn't actually improve my A-levels desperately at the end of the second year in the sixth form. But all was well, and I went on to Cranwell with one further hurdle to pass, because just a couple of months before I went to Cranwell, we had to go back to Biggin Hill for a final medical. And I passed the eye test again, but the doctor who did the general medical approached me when I was sitting in a chair and asked me to look upwards at him. And when I look upwards, then one eye wanders, which is obviously a muscular thing. And he noted this and said, oh, we'll need to look into this in far more detail. So more tests were done. Nothing could be found actually wrong with my eyesight in terms of but this muscular thing. So I was then referred back to the Central Medical Establishment in London. And I went from school to there and turned up and was kept waiting for some hours in this outer office of the consultant, where I learnt upwards, backwards and sideways all the eye charts that were on view in his office, because I thought, you know, at least I can get all of that right. And when this chap eventually returned after a long lunch, he said he wasn't quite sure why I'd been sent down there. And I said, well, when I look up, one eye wanders off to the left. He didn't ask me to look at any of the eye charts and things of that nature. He said, well, you look perfectly fit to me, without even asking me to look upwards. Said, I've got to go and play golf. Off you go. Don't bother wasting my time. And that was it. And so I passed the medical, and I have lived with this sort of slight eye problem for forever. It's never posed me with any problems, but it was never either sort of taken any real notice of. So I went to Cranwell in 1963 in the autumn there. And again, I really enjoyed Cranwell. Cranwell left a huge mark on me. It was, in many ways, a boarding school for 18 to 21-year-olds. We had obviously considerably more freedom than we'd had at boarding school after the first 6 weeks of confined to barracks was over. But it was a combination, again, of sort of academic study and, you know, reasonably serious academic study, leadership training through drill and other aspects, a lot of sport and all sorts of other interests that one could pursue, and of course flying, sort of at the beginning of our second year. So I really enjoyed Cranwell, and I just found that the ethos of the place got to me. My wife tells me I probably had a sort of a brain operation there, a lobotomy or something of that nature, but I came away from Cranwell totally committed to the service. I had so enjoyed the sort of the way in which it seemed to go about its business, the fun of it. I mean, it was tremendous fun as well as hard work. So I left Cranwell in the sort of the summer of 66, really, really delighted that I had chosen this as a route, and I have always looked back on Cranwell, I suppose in the same way as youngsters look back at their universities, as almost a sort of a spiritual home. And whenever I go back to Cranwell these days, it always is a pleasant experience.
Now, I just want to ask whether the course that you did, the academic study, would that have approximated in any way to the what one would have got at undertaking a bachelor's degree at university or not?
No, I don't think in fairness it would. There were some who were able to get an Aeronautical Society qualification out of it, and through doing sort of some of the exams to a higher standard, and came away with a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society sort of label behind their name. But no, I don't think it would have. That said, there's no doubt in my mind that if we had that course going today, we would get an external degree for the totality of the course. Some years after I left, it was thought possible that we could get the course turned into a degree course, but the external organisations of the day said that the course would need to be lengthened by probably another year, with more emphasis on the academic side, so that it would be a four-year course and the totality of everything done would constitute a first degree. But the Air Force was not prepared to have its young officers there for 4 years. The cost of that was deemed to be too expensive, and so the service slowly went away from the old Cranwell concept of a three-year non-degree course to really selecting university graduates with a first degree and then putting them through a very much shorter, initially sort of, you know, 4.5 month course, now 6 month course at Cranwell, to turn them from being postgraduates into officers for the service. In terms of what I think it was a great shame that we didn't persist with trying to get the Cranwell course recognised as a degree course, because although we do need young men and women with degrees, we don't need them all to have degrees of a particular nature. We don't need them all to be aeronautical engineers or history or whatever. People with a knowledge of war studies and things of that nature, of electronics, thermodynamics, things of that nature, together with the other aspects of what Cranwell used to be, I think would produce very rounded officers for our service, even into this age when technology is so much more important than perhaps it was in the mid-60s. So I think it is a shame that we didn't persist with that. What we have done instead, as I say, is tended to select many more people from university, not least because all the youngsters want to go to university. What we're now doing, which I think is a useful idea, we are saying to some people, don't go to university, come and join the service straight from the age of 18, so that we can get you into flying earlier and get more productive flying out of you before you get not too old, but too senior and things of that nature. And at some stage, we will make sure that we can find you a way of getting a degree if that's what you want, and you can do it externally through Exeter on a war studies type basis. And a number of youngsters are responding to that, although I think most still feel that a degree in the bag is a useful insurance policy against not being successful in getting through the degree of the training stream in the Air Force, particularly the air crew. But I think if one could go back to 66, 68, 70, that thing, then I think we ought to have persisted more with the Cranwell course. But we didn't. That's history now, and it's gone. So I graduated from Cranwell in the summer of 66 as an acting pilot officer. I think the flying training at Cranwell, I certainly was in no way a star. I think I was adequate. But I think the sort of the first half of the course, I think probably, if I was able to read the sort of the reports, would probably say that I was very average and struggled a bit in certain aspects. Towards the end of the Jet Provost course at Cranwell, I think things were slowly coming into place. I certainly wasn't a front runner on the course, but I think some of the more applied flying that we had started to do at that stage, particularly formation flying, was something where I did show considerably better promise, and therefore perhaps the sort of the course was performance was rising towards the end of the 2 year wings course rather than a linear one, and certainly therefore I left Cranwell sort of happier with my flying than I might have been sort of at the halfway stage, but by no means was I a star. But nevertheless, I was selected to go on to Valley, which was the sort of the fast stream or the jet stream course, as opposed to Oakington, which was for people going basically on to multi-engine and transport command. Although I had a short while to wait before going there, and I held at Stradishall as a co-pilot on Domini's flying navigators for their training, which was a slightly tedious process, but it was de rigueur, and we had about 6 or 8 weeks to wait before we could get on to Valley. Valley, up in Anglesey, was where I think I did start to make some real progress with flying. For some reason, the gnat caught the imagination. It was technically a very advanced aeroplane for its day, particularly for a trainer. The instrumentation to fit, the sensors and aids that the aircraft had, both for navigation and for precision flying, were really very advanced indeed. And of course, it was quite a high-performance aeroplane, capable of sort of 550 knots, and being so small, the impression of speed was remarkable. And the first flight I had in that, which was very much for the instructor's benefit, we were halfway through ground school and we'd get this one flight just to whet our appetite. We knew how to start it, but once we'd started it, then the instructor in the back seat flew the whole of the sortie. And my instructor was a small Scotsman called Mac McKenzie. And he flew me through the mountains of Wales and things of that nature at heights that I had never seen before, at speeds I'd not experienced before. And therefore, again, sort of the sense of enthusiasm and keenness to get on and fly this aeroplane were enormous, and certainly saw us through the rest of ground school without any difficulty whatsoever. But the gnat course did go well, and I think partly I put that down to, as I said, a sort of a growing ability in the air, but also to, again, this determination that I've always had to try and do everything as well as I possibly can. And that I used to write a book or a couple of pages after every sortie, debriefing myself how well it had gone, what the sortie consisted of, what I'd done well, what I hadn't done well, what I needed to improve on, points to remind myself. And then I would read that again through sort of in the evening or again the following morning before the next sortie. And I still feel that actually helped me considerably to get the most out of every hour in the air.
Now, these were entirely private to you.
Yes.
No one knew that you had.
No.
It's like just like a private diary.
Yes. Right. Yeah. But it's certainly, I would draw diagrams and remind myself of facts and figures and things of that nature. Record all the comments that my instructor had made in his debrief, and therefore which he would presumably transpose to his record of the sortie, and then I would use that to brief myself before the next flight. With the net result was that I did well on that particular course. I was at this chap Mac McKenzie's house about 2 weeks before the end of the course, and fairly late at night he said, come and sit behind the sofa with me. So we were sat behind the sofa against the wall. He said, I've got some news for you. And I said, oh, what's that? And he said, well, you're going to the Central Flying School from here. And I said, oh, well, that's a blow. Because I had wanted to go onto a hunter squadron. That was seemed to me to be where young men should go, not to the Central Flying School to be a creamed-off instructor. And he said, well, I'm sorry, he said, but, you know, you've done sufficiently well on the course to warrant going to CFS, and that's what they've decided. So over the next 2 weeks, I sort of got used to it. Actually, if that's the way it had worked out, I'm sure I would have got on with it, made the most, and so forth. And it would have been interesting to see what would have happened thereafter. But at the final sort of guest night, where postings were read out to individuals, it was announced at the end that I would actually be going to a hunter squadron. Not going to the Central Flying School, which, as you can imagine, was a moment of some elation and unexpected after this conversation I'd had with Mac. And I went up to him straight after the meal and said, what went on? And he said, well, he said, we the instructors all got together and things of that nature a week or so ago and decided that the person who came top of the course ought to get his best, get his first choice, regardless of where the system thought, and that's why you're going where you're going and not going to the Central Flying School, which meant that somebody, the number two on the course, I think, went to the Central Flying School rather than myself. So poor chap, he sort of picked the short straw rather than me. But no, Valley was a nice place. I think it's an area where you either like it or you loathe it, because of the weather and the fresh air and things of that nature. It's not the place for going to cinemas and nightclubs and things of that nature, but it was a good place to fly from.
It seems, well, I'm interested to say it was a good place to fly from, because it seems an odd place to go, given the weather, that you're always battling against no cloud or whatever.
Yes, I mean, the weather changes very quickly as well, and goes from sort of blue in terms of good weather to red in terms of bad weather very quickly, and you do get extremes, but the weather factor actually is not that bad if you take it throughout the year. Better than Broadie, for example, which was a station we then took back from the Navy at one stage. Similar sort of weather pattern, but because Broadie sits up on the hill, then they do suffer a lot from low cloud. But Valley, actually, the weather factor is quite good. And when we've looked at it subsequently as to whether we should...